on Tome de Kami. And for the website also, I put it on the website. So just beware. So we, you know, basically the purpose of this class is to help prepare for Pesach. One of the halachas that's brought down at the beginning of Hilchos Pesach is that you start learning the halachas of Pesach 30 days prior, which is disagreeing whether it means on Purim itself or the day after Purim. But either way, you know, it says specifically by Pesach. You know, there's a disagreement whether it applies to other holidays also. But everyone agrees it applies to Pesach. And the reason is because Pesach is a very complicated holiday. There's a lot of halachas that come up that are basically you don't deal with most of the year, because chametz is something that you don't deal with most of the year. Which, by the way, is one of the reasons why we have a stringency for chametz. You know, even if one drop falls in, we say it's not kosher. So some learn. The reason is because since Tosfos says, since during the year you're used to having chametz, so the rabbis want to make sure you're very careful, like staying totally away from chametz. And if it's this big stringency is on it, then you'll be freaked out from it, which most people are nowadays. That was one of the purposes, because since we do eat chametz the whole year, as evidenced by the wafer crackers. On Pesach, it's like a new thing. It's like something that's sort of like you're not used to the whole year. So therefore, specifically at Pesach, it says you're supposed to prepare 30 days before. So we're definitely within 30 days, and it just shows you the level of importance it gives to preparing for Pesach, that specifically said 30 days, it takes that much time to get yourself ready for Pesach, since there's so many different elements to the holiday that needs to you need preparation for. So that's basically the purpose of the class, and it's also to answer questions, because a lot of things come up because of the fact that Pesach is a very multifaceted holiday. A lot of things come up that you don't think about during the year. And we're going to focus specifically, and you could, you know, if someone has any other types of questions, fine, but let's focus specifically on kashrut and cleaning. Those are two things that are probably the top two topics regarding Pesach preparation that at least are asked to me, and I find in the world that people want to know about. So that's what we're going to focus on. And so one of the things that I always like to start this class off with was a statement of Yaakov Kamenetsky, who said, in general, the job of a rabbi is to make things easier on people, not more complicated. And that's somewhat forgotten nowadays. But that's really what I'm here to try to do, is make things easier. And I don't mean easier by breaking halacha. I just mean easier, maybe more practical, by keeping halacha. And some of the things in halacha are not clear, and a lot of people treat certain prohibitions. Hey guys, how are you? Just pull. Yeah, chas and kala. Whatever you think. I mean, for now, if you don't mind sitting at the table, it's fine. If solid people come, maybe we'll bring another table. So I was saying that, as an introduction, that Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky said the job of a rabbi is making things easier on people. And when it comes to Pesach, I really believe that dictum. Because there's a lot of information out there. And one of the other things I say is that if someone reads something from a trusted source, then if the person who writes that halacha, or whatever it is when it comes to halacha, is lenient, you could rely on what they say, and if they're stringent, you should ask a question. And the reason I say it that way, that's one of my rules, is because people usually don't think those terms, but the reason I use it that way is because stringencies are something that's safe for people. And no one likes to ruffle feathers, especially if you're in a public forum. And it's understandable, because there's a lot of very aggressive, right-wing religious people out there who are out to get people. And unfortunately, I've learned that in my career, that that's just the way it is. And therefore, it's a lot easier to write things that are not controversial. So generally speaking, unless someone's known to be controversial, people will not outright write things that are controversial. But what happens is it blurs the lines, because people start not seeing the difference between something that's not allowed and something that may be allowed in certain circumstances, or may be allowed outright, but is not publicized because of the fear that there are opinions that say that are stringent that might get the person into trouble if he puts himself out there and says that it's allowed. So that's one of the jobs of a rabbi, is to have questions that come up asked to them, and the rabbi's job is to try to size up the certain situations, certain circumstance. And like, people I know who have a relationship with Moshe Feinstein, you know, there's a lot of differences of opinion about what Moshe Feinstein's held about certain topics, and the reason is because this is my understanding, he used to answer people based on the way they asked the question, who asked the question, and he would have the same question one person, he would say, oh, that's, you know, someone say, you know, this is not allowed, right? He'd say, yeah, it's not allowed. And the next person would say, this is okay, right? He'd say, yeah, it's okay. And it would be the same thing. And like, the question is, you know, why? And the answer is because halacha is not as black and white as people might make it out to be, or some people prefer it to be. It's a lot of areas of gray. And because of that, it's important to clarify in your specific circumstance what is allowed, what's not allowed, and, you know, certain things that are clearly black and white. Like, for instance, do not eat a loaf of bread on Pesach. Black and white. Okay? That's clear, right? But there's a lot of gray, which come, what about products that don't have a hechsher? What about, in terms of cleaning for Pesach, do I have to, like, get a remodeled kitchen for Pesach, you know? Do I have to bomb the place? I mean, what do I have to do to make things kosher for Pesach? There's a lot of room in gray that gives you, room to, for your specific circumstance to deal with your case. So we're going to try to deal with these issues in a serious way, and try to understand how a lot of the perceptions out there may not be true, and explain why. So when it comes to, we'll start, I guess, with preparing. So one of the things I mentioned before was that the rabbis made, rabbis, when I refer to the rabbis, I don't mean some bunch of rabbis on a mountain, I mean talking about this is our tradition, our Masorah, which is brought down in the Gemara, and brought down in Shulchan Aruch and Halacha. And it's, when I mean the rabbis, I mean it's rabbinical as opposed to biblical. And that is, the Torah says that you're not allowed to eat chametz on Pesach. And most of the commentators say that means that you're not allowed to eat a certain amount of chametz. That would be, let's say, according to many, it would be a size of what's known as kazayas, which is, let's say, half a slice of bread. That would be, according to most, the biblical prohibition of eating chametz on Pesach. However, there are the rabbinical injunctions were made, as I mentioned, because we're used to eating bread, and we're used to eating chametz. And when we're talking about chametz, by the way, it's anything of the five grains, not just wheat, which we're used to. It's oats, spelt, barley, and rye. Those five, wheat, spelt, oats, barley, and rye, are the five grains. Those are the ones that you have to have a high alert for. Anything that is not specifically made in a way, like matzah, it's not made in any specific way that's kosher l'Pesach, is very problematic, because it could violate the biblical prohibition of eating chametz and Pesach. Be very careful about those five ingredients. So when it comes to smaller amounts, that's where the rabbinical injunctions come in, and they say, look, you know, we have to stay far away from chametz because we're used to eating it during the year. So the rabbinical prohibition went in so far that not just any food that's itself is chametz, and again, there are differences of opinion. Some say that even smaller amounts are biblical, but even if it's mixed into other food. So if you have chametz mixed into other food, it still potentially could be a problem. So normally we say that if food is mixed into other food accidentally, it's nullified in 60. But the rabbi said, and the reason for that is because of taste, that beyond 60 we assume there's no taste of non-kosher food, and the problem of taste is an issue if it's something's mixed in, because even if it's nullified in the majority, it's not a majority, which the Torah says clearly is one of the things that will nullify something is majority. If you have 51% of one food, 49% of the other, so the 51% takes over and the 49% is as if it's not there, so to speak. But when it comes to taste, so there's a special prohibition that's brought down, and there's a difference of opinion whether that's biblical or rabbinical, but either way, it's not allowed to taste non-kosher food, even if it's less than 50% of the food. the rabbis assumed that it used to be they used to hire people to taste food, and actually some Sfaradim do that nowadays because the Shulchan Aruch says you can hire a non-Jew to taste the food to see if you can taste pork or something, even if it's more than 160, it's still going to be okay because the person's telling you that there's no taste. We don't really do that nowadays. That was something they used to do in some circles. Nowadays we just say the term 1 in 60, which is about 1.66%, and we say if it's less than 1.66%, then we assume there's no taste. Now, that only applies in a situation where the thing itself is not made for taste. If something's made for taste, then it could even taste beyond that, and that might be an issue, like a flavoring or something like that. That might be an issue even less than 1.66%. Generally speaking, we say if it's less than 1.66%, then it's nullified because, A, it's less than 50%, and B, there's no taste. So the rabbinical injunction on Pesach went beyond that and said that even if it's one in a million, it's still one crumb of chametz in a big vat of soup make the whole vat of soup not kosher Pesach. And the reason is because of the stringency, as I mentioned before. One of the reasons is, the logic behind it is, since we're so used to eating chametz, so therefore this keeps us far away from chametz. So that gives you an idea of how serious this issue is, that in your kitchen, when crumbs of chametz are all over the place, because even if someone's very clean, it's very hard to protect yourself from crumbs. So dealing with crumbs is something that we're going to speak about. But just understand why the people are so crazy about Pesach. That this is the main issue, because even one crumb of chametz that falls into food by accident would make the whole food not kosher or Pesach. So that's something that is very important to keep in mind. That's why I say the main focus of cleaning has to be in the kitchen. Because generally speaking, no crumbs are going to fall into other food in your bedroom. Okay, you could eat in your bedroom. I eat in my bedroom, right? Miriam and I eat dinner every night, you know, watching Netflix in our bedroom, and that's just the way it is. You know, we set up a whole thing over there, and we eat in our bedroom. So for us, we have to check our bedroom, but it's not as serious as the kitchen. We don't really have a kitchen in that apartment, but if we did, we have something there. Basically, the counters are very serious because in the bedroom, you're not cooking soup and chicken and everything else, but in the kitchen, you are, and those crumbs potentially could ruin your food. So that's a very serious issue that has to be dealt with specifically in the kitchen. But Shulchan Aruch says when you check for chametz, and that's also a rabbinical thing on the Thursday before, it's very important to check Thursday night. This year, it's 2 weeks from tonight. As soon as it gets dark outside, it's supposed to check. They consider it to be a very serious thing to check for chametz, to the extent that they said you got to do it right away because it's like a bris. A bris, every moment on the eighth day, once the eighth day comes, you're violating the prohibition. You got to do it. So they turned that, it's called a mitzvah overis in Talmudic language. Mitzvah overis means a mitzvah that passes. A mitzvah that passes means that once the time comes to the mitzvah, every second that goes by, you're missing out on performing that mitzvah. It's not like you have the whole night. Like Shema, you have the whole night. You have to the third hour to say Shema in the morning. So there's no, you're not violating anything by not saying it until the last minute. Also davening in the morning, for instance. You have until the fourth hour of the day. Right? You're not violating anything if you daven at the last minute. You fulfilled the commandment. The Chometz, they made it different. They said every minute that passes by, this is what the Bach explains, every minute that passes by, you're violating this prohibition, of the rabbinical prohibition of not checking your house for Chometz unless you have some a good reason. If a good reason not to do it, you know, if it's a marital issue, then I would, you know, the rabbis weren't saying that you should ruin your marriage for this, but I'm just saying if you're watching a game or something and doing something recreational, you should stop and you should check for chametz right away because of this prohibition that every minute passes by is you're violating the fact you're not checking your house for chametz, because it is a very important thing that must be prioritized. That's the point. But however, even though that's true, that's not when you should start preparing your house for chametz, because you're not enough time just to wait till the night before Pesach. You should be well prepared in advance before you check for chametz, so that the checking for chametz itself really shouldn't take you more than, I mean, some people say hours. I say, if you already prepared beforehand, it shouldn't take you more than half an hour to check for chametz, because you know your house is all about, you know what's going on, and checking for chametz is just for checking over it, making sure you didn't forget anything. But you're not starting from scratch. And really, that should not be done. You know, chametz preparation, Pesach preparation should be done well in advance. So, but the night before, the checking has to be done in your house. That's the main aspect. It says bevatechem, that there shouldn't be chametz in your house. People ask me about their cars all the time. So a car is not in the obligation to check for chametz. However, it's another issue which comes to a car, which is that we are concerned that if you have chametz in your car, that you might eat chametz on Pesach. So in other words, one of the issues for checking for chametz is that you're not allowed to have chametz in your possession, in your home, in your possession on Pesach. That is a prohibition from the Torah. You can't have chametz. Now when it says chametz, it's talking about a significant amount of chametz. It's talking about a kazayas. It's talking about a large amount of chametz. However, Tosis brings down, this is according to those opinions who say, which is, I'd say majority of opinions that say that eating even a little bit of chametz is not allowed biblically. They say that you have to check for chametz because even if you find an amount that you would eat, like a little Cheerio, for instance, even though it's less than that, you have to check for that. So basically what this tells you is there's two reasons why you're checking. One is that you shouldn't have in your possession a significant amount of chametz. That's a person. As long as it's not a mouse.
Oh. Big one.
Yeah. Significant amount of chametz in your possession, that it's not shouldn't be there. And the second thing is that you should have chametz you might eat. Hey, Dahlia, how are you?
Hey.
Just pull up a chair.
Okay. But I was a kid, and they handed it to me.
Okay.
I put them with a lot on the bathroom.
Okay, great.
Thank you. Okay.
Have a good night.
Good.
So, yeah, that's the other reason is you might have food that's chametz you might eat. Now, owning chametz in your possession is taken care of very easily by selling it. There's a whole difference of opinion about what you could sell, but the simple halacha is that the custom in Jewish people has been to do this quote-unquote trick, which is you just sell your chametz to a non-Jew, and if you do that, now, all I do is when someone sends me the name, I'm acting as their agent to help them out, which means that it's called Zachma Elam Shalafanov, that I could act as someone's agent to help them out even if they're not there because they want me to do it. They've already given me consent. So therefore, I'm going to this non-Jew and I'm actually working through someone else. A cousin of mine is a rabbi who helps me out with this. And he goes to non-Jew, takes the list of names, and makes a transaction with non-Jew and says, you're buying all the chametz for whatever amount of money, and thereby that agreement says, in halacha, that all the chametz in your house that would otherwise be in your possession is now no longer in your possession. Okay. However, there is this other issue of eating. So in order to get around that, to avoid that issue, the proper thing to do is to make sure you know where all your chametz is in your house. So you should prepare by putting your chametz into specific areas in your house, and then just taping up the cabinets and knowing where they are. I don't require people to identify where the chametz is. Some deeds of sale have that. It's not necessary to do that because really what we're saying is any chametz in the house is in the sale, no matter where it is, and that's a valid sale. It's not necessary to identify that. At the same time, a person should know where the chametz is just for themselves because it's a haphazard otherwise. You open your fridge and you have, whatever it is, you have your granola sitting there. You shouldn't do that. You might eat it. So to avoid that problem, you really should organize your house in such a way that all the chametz is put into an area where you can identify it and you know where it is, and it's preferably taped up or locked up or just put in a place where you're not going to access it on Pesach. If it has to be in the refrigerator or in the freezer, then you have to put it on the side. You should put it in a bag or something, tape it up, write chametz on it, so make sure it's clearly identified as chametz. Like I said, in terms of preparing for Pesach before this bedikah, the kitchen has to be the main focus. The prohibition is only the place that has to be checked are only places, Shulchan Aruch says, that you would generally bring chametz there. In other words, you have a suspicion that there might be chametz in that room. So if you never eat in your bedroom, which should be the case, as opposed to my situation, but then there's no reason why you have to check your bedroom. Unless you think, wow, like for instance, you have kids or something, where they might bring in, things that you never would dreamed of in your bedroom that people might eat. But if you're afraid that there's like crumbs on the floor that's not your first concern. That doesn't necessarily have to be a concern, because no one's going to eat crumbs on the floor. You know, if you don't eat in your bedroom, there's chances are there's no crumbs that are chametz on the floor anyway. So that would mean that in that situation, the bedroom doesn't have to be checked at all for chametz, because there's no reason for you to assume if there's like a 1% chance it's chametz, then that's not your obligation to start checking places that it's crazy to have chametz there. So that could eliminate for many people a lot of checking or cleaning for Pesach. And you know, it's nice to clean your bedroom if you like to clean your bedroom. It's fine to have the cleaner to do that if you bring one over. And I would recommend that anyone who's cleaning to bring over someone to help them. It's very, very good investment. But they could clean your bedroom. But in terms of Pesach, any area which you're not afraid that you're going to have chametz, where you know that's not identified, might be eaten, or might be something that would be quote unquote in your possession, you're not aware of. If it's a place that you wouldn't have to suspect that, your bathroom, you know what I'm saying? You don't have to check your bathroom for chametz. Now, people ask me about, just as a side, this issue about cosmetics. The bottom line of cosmetics is there are differences of opinion, but the truth is there aren't really differences of opinion. It became this really blown out of proportion issue regarding cosmetics. One of the main issues they say is because of alcohol, since the alcohol is potentially edible in shampoos and all these, you know, colognes and things like that, and the alcohol might be from a source of chametz, then you have an issue. But most opinions hold that, and this is my custom, that you do not have to check any toiletries for Pesach at all. It's not edible. It's not edible. No one's going to wolf down some shampoo. It's just not going to happen. You know what I'm saying? Even mouthwash, which some people have an issue with, is not really an issue. You know, if some people don't like this, you put it in your mouth. It's not edible. It's not food, right? So something you would put in your mouth, you know, you want to double check, make sure. But my investigation has shown that most alcohol in mouthwash is not chametz anyway. So all these cosmetic issues, you know, my practice is not to even deal with it. I don't check any cosmetics. With toothpastes, most toothpaste is not an issue. They have lists, but I haven't found any toothpaste that really has an issue with chametz in it.
But I thought that all the like matters that you just have to do with, you shall not benefit from it, and it's not only eating.
That's true. That's true. But again, benefit from chametz is relative, and we say that if it's completely nifsal. It's not edible at all, so that's not called benefit. It's not. It's like not food. It's not. It's not considered food anymore, right? Benefit would be like, for instance, you feed your pet. Feeding your pet on Pesach is a benefit. Selling chametz that's edible is. But like, for instance, like in halacha and kashrus, if it's spoiled, it's not food. It's not considered to be food anymore, right? So similarly, if it's not edible, not by a human, but by a dog. Which we assume shampoo is not edible by a dog. This is what the Chazon Ish. Chazon Ish says, who you know, he's normally very stringent. His opinion says straight out that all these cosmetics and toiletries are not an issue. It's not food, not edible food for dogs, and they're completely out of reach. You know, some might boil out the alcohol if you'd like to, but you know that's what some say. Some say that Rav Moshe Feinstein said, which I don't think he said at all. One of his students said, he said if you boil out the alcohol, alcoholic would drink the alcohol. But that's really far fetched.
And the ownership isn't an issue because it's not.
Because
food.
It's not considered to be chametz anymore because it's not edible. It's not considered to be right.
So the is that the process comes is something that's. It has to be food.
Right, it has to be edible. That's what chametz is. Think about it. Chametz is something that's food. If it's turned into non-food, then it's not chametz anymore. I mean, the prohibition is eating chametz. And it's true, there is a prohibition from getting pleasure from chametz, but that's, again, it's a stretch to say that's called pleasure from chametz if it's not edible. So, therefore, I just ignore all the cosmetics, which... Yeah, you know, I used to not because years ago when I used to believe those books that they used to give out to me, and I got smarter and I started looking into halacha. But it drove you crazy. I mean, because you go nuts trying to find the kosher Pesach, whatever it is, eye drops. I mean, how far do you go? You know what I'm saying? So that is one of the things that, you know, if anyone's been doing until now, should make things a lot easier. So again, so then we then basically we're focusing on places that you would bring chametz into. But like I said, if it's like a bedroom or something like that, then you should do a search for any place in the bedroom that chametz might be, and just clean it, get rid of it, that so that there's no edible chametz in the area that someone might eat. Now, you know, you say, you know, who's going to eat a Cheerio that's sitting behind the dresser for like, you know, 5 months? And that's true, but that's still something that's, Tosis would say, is a gliska yafa. It's something that's potentially edible. You should get rid of it. And the same thing in your car. You know, car is something you use. If you should scan the car, look at the car for any food that might be edible. If there's, you know, if you want to vacuum the car, that's a nice thing to do. But if it's just crumbs you're dealing with, that's really, no one's going to eat those crumbs. If it's like an Oreo cookie crumbs that clearly are like bunched into an area, you should get rid of that, you know. And the easiest thing I would say for a lot of these things is you could spray it with like some sort of like a cleaning spray. And that makes it totally inedible because the, you know, that way you sort of cover yourself. Like even though it's crumbs, you know, crumbs are probably not edible. They're sitting on the floor, that one steps on, you know, no one's going to eat that. But you spray the spray, or, you know, to clean your car a little bit or vacuum it for sure, then you get rid of it. But, you know, vacuuming behind the seats is, Rav Hanan used to tell us that that's not necessary because it's like there's a halacha that if a wall falls on chametz, you don't have to start picking up the wall because it's not can't get to it. So no one's reaching behind the seat is something that's not, a normal person doesn't do, try to find chametz in there, you know. So some people have like whole cookies in there, so I would personally try to get rid of that, you know, because it is in your sort of your possession and it could be large piece of chametz. But anything like crumbs, you don't have to worry about in your car as well. Or in any place in your house that is not your kitchen that you're cooking and food might get into. So again, so these things, if you have someone helping you clean, definitely will help because they use cleanser on the floor. You could assume that anything that might have been edible is, you know, Mr. Clean's on it. You know, no one's going to eat it and it's probably gone. But you should do an inspection just to make sure a lot of cleaning help is not that careful about stuff behind behind dressers and things like that. So it's better to do an inspection to make sure. But again, that shouldn't take you a long time. It should be very easy to do that. Only in places, again, that chametz is brought in, that you know about, that is normally brought in there, that you would be concerned that there might be chametz there. So therefore, even if you don't have cleaning help, if you do have cleaning help, all that shouldn't take you more than a few minutes. You know, we eliminated any place that you don't bring chametz into. We eliminated the bathroom, basically, and all the cosmetics. And the rest of the house that you bring, wherever you bring food into, it just requires an inspection of behind any places that you would not suspect, you know, that chametz might have fallen into, you know, just to look around. But that shouldn't take you too long either. The main focus, and it's very important to say this because a lot of people focus on their whole house. And then by the time they get to their kitchen, they're exhausted. And they're like, oh, forget it. I'm like, that's the fire that you have to focus on. The main room is your kitchen. So in terms of, like, let's say a refrigerator, that's the easiest thing because refrigerator is cold. So the issue would be that you might eat something. But transfer of taste is not going to happen in your refrigerator. So therefore, it's nice to clean your refrigerator. I'm not against it. I think it's a good thing to do. You should do it anyway during the year. And for Pesach, it's a very good time to clean your refrigerator. But I wouldn't say it's totally necessary to clean every inch of your refrigerator. I mean, if you just look in your refrigerator, inspect your refrigerator, see if there's anything that's edible, that chametz, you know, the grape jelly that's on the side of the fridge that someone spilled. You know, you should clean it if you want to, but it's not like that's not something you have to worry about for Pesach. It's like the loaf of bread that's sitting there, you know, something that's really chametz. That you got to get rid of, or at the very least, you should, like I said, wrap it up and put it aside so that it's, and label it as chametz so that no one eats it. And then, there are gray area products. There are products that are, and people ask this all the time, products that are either kosher Pesach that are used during the year or and we'll deal with the products that are not labeled Kasher LePesach that still might be Kasher LePesach anyway, that have been used. So the bottom line is you have to determine whether it's the same thing as your bedroom. Did it come into contact with chametz? For instance, if you have peanut butter and your custom is, you know, your practice is to take knife, peanut butter, stick it on your bread, and stick the knife back in your peanut butter, I would stay away from the peanut butter because, I mean, there's probably chametz in the peanut butter. But anything else that, you know, people say, you know, just like opening the package, it doesn't get the cooties. It doesn't become chametz because you open the package if you can determine that no chametz went inside the package. So therefore, if some package is open, then you could determine, you know, under your discretion that there's no chametz in there, then that's something you could use on Pesach. But although if there's something you're in doubt about, again, all these things that you're in doubt about that my chametz might be inside, the best thing to do is to put it aside. You don't have to throw it out. The Ramban says there's a mitzvah once Rosh Chodesh hits that you eat chametz. Is a mitzvah of tashbis, you should get rid of the chametz from your house. So you should have kavana, have intention that everything, all the chametz you eat 2 weeks before Pesach is fulfilling this mitzvah of getting rid of your chametz. It's something, right, you get eat a lot. It's a good thing to do to minimize the chametz in your house. But if you can't get rid of it, then just wrap it up, put it on the side, make sure you know where it is, and you don't eat it on Pesach, and that's taken care of. Same thing with the freezer, same thing with your cabinets. And cabinets, I'll say the same thing. If you have a cabinet, if there are crumbs, you should clean it. But what cleaning means isn't like, you know, with a fine-tooth comb. Cleaning just means take some Fantastic, spray it on the thing, wipe it up, look to see there's nothing edible, and you're okay. You're not going to eat crumbs with Fantastic on it. I mean, you're just not going to do that. So that really shouldn't take too much time to do in terms of just spraying down the cabinets and just going through all the food, making sure there's no chametz or anything that might have come into contact with chametz that has been opened. Then the next stuff that you potentially use for heat, with heat, and that you get more complicated. So for instance, the counters could come into contact with heat. However, the issue with counters is that most of the time, the great majority of the time, perhaps all the time, you don't put pots on the counter that's cleanly shown that's chametz. Very, very uncommon to do that. Meaning that the actual, not just the pot itself, but the chametz itself comes in direct contact with the counter in a level what's known as kli rishon, which is the first level cooking, which is on a pot on the stove. Not very common for that to happen on a counter. So what usually happens on the counter is that you, the very worst, some pasta from the pot fell on the counter and that was hot, so that could transfer taste to the counter. Stuff like that could happen. But it's usually kli sheni, which means or kli rishon, which means it's poured out of the first vessel. That also is generally not common, but it could happen. So the difference of opinion about this, my practice is that there's two issues over here. One is that what's people make an issue about what the counter is made out of, because some things can't be kosher. So if most countertops, they write in these books, can't be kosher, because the only things that can be kosher are like metal. What else could be kosher? Not too much else. You know, anything like made out of like a stone is a problem. Glass is a problem, potentially. All of these Pyrex things, all these type of, what these countertops made out of, whatever. They have different types from mica, right? That's like sort of like a plastic type of material. So all these things are potentially problematic because it could be in the category of something as a kli cheres. Kli cheres means a earthenware vessel. Earthenware vessels are problematic because earthenware vessels are treated in a sense like food, in a sense that if it absorbs something not kosher, you can't really kosher it. You can't get rid of it. And if you, now that's a big if, but if you treat these countertops like earthenware vessels, then potentially what could happen is you could say it's not kosherable. So that's why a lot of people, what they'll do is they'll cover their counters with 16 layers of tinfoil, and you know what I'm saying? And I used to do it also. But then I looked into halacha, I realized it's not necessary to do that. It's not clear as day that this is called earthenware anyway, which means it's not clear, it's not kosherable. Number one. Number two, which is more important, the absorption of chametz is also in doubt in this situation. And even though it's true, the Shulchan Aruch says that, Ramah brings down, that normally we say that after 24 hours, the taste is gone. And that's the case with chametz too, it's spoiled. After 24 hours, we say it's spoiled. So if you have non-kosher taste in a pot or in a counter or whatever it is, 24 hours later, it's all gone. So we say that on Pesach we're stringent and we don't go with that leniency in general. We don't say that 24-hour rule, which means no same time left gone. If it's spoiled after 24 hours, the very general principle is that we'll say that we treat it with stringency. However, if there's any type of doubt, we don't have to worry about that rule. Because itself is a really big stringency in itself, and not everyone agrees to that rule. So, if there's any type of doubt, like in this situation, there's multiple doubts about whether even chametz got absorbed by the countertop. Another reason is because there are some opinions who say that these type of materials don't absorb anything, especially if it's glazed or something with glass or something, a lot of that, or glass type material. So because of all this, my recommendation is for a countertop is to spray it with some sort of poisonous fantastic or ammonia or something like that. Clean the countertops with that. And that will, in many ways, kosher it. Because of all these doubts, and on top of it, what you're doing is you're inserting a spoiled taste into the countertop so that whatever was in there, even if it was chametz, but now it's doubly spoiled. Now it's spoiled because it's 24 hours, and now you kill it with ammonia, you know. So this is a way, in my opinion, around having to cover all the counters, and it makes your life a lot easier. Cleaning counters has a double advantage in that if there are any crumbs on your countertops, this ammonia, whatever solution, will spoil those crumbs as well, and not have to, you know, hopefully they won't get your food. If there was any potential for that, you don't have to worry about that happening. You also don't have to worry about, unless you think there's a serious amount of food between the crevices in your kitchen, you know, you feel like donuts fell in there or something, you know, cookies or something. But if that's not the case, the crumbs, it's not something you just have to worry about. If there's a place that it's easy for you to spray some ammonia in there just to kill everything, so to speak, from taste-wise, then that's a good practice to do. But again, these things shouldn't take you too long to do. I mean, to cleaning out your cabinets, spraying all your countertops with ammonia are fantastic, and just cleaning it well, you know, every inch of your countertops shouldn't take you more than a few minutes to do that. And that will effectively kosher your countertops. When it comes to your sink, so again, different is opinion about the sink. My practice is, say, it's very similar to a countertop in the sense that it's very rare you can actually have like boiling hot chametz. You know, the worst case scenario in my kitchen is I have a colander, I pour pasta into the colander, and then the water drips into the sink. So it is hot, but it's not clear that's hot enough. It's cliché-y that it would transfer taste to the sink. So I can't think of any worse than that happening in my sink. So basically, the best thing to do is just to clean the same way you would your countertops with the ammonia solution. You have a 24-hour rule together with the ammonia destroying the taste doubly, and the fact that it might not absorb. But if you have a stainless steel sink, then you know some people will take hot water and pour it all around it. I don't think that's a bad idea because it is kosherable, a stainless steel sink. The countertop sinks are not kosherable anyway, so that you don't have choices over here. It's not like you could pour hot water on it and it wouldn't necessarily help anyway, according to so many opinions. So someone wants to do that and pour hot water on their whole counters. I used to do that also, and it's really annoying because the water spills everywhere, and like, you know, I don't think it's necessary to do, but in a sink is a little easier because it's a drain. So if you want to pour hot water all over your sink, you know, take a kettle and pour hot water in the sink. It's a good thing to do, and that will kosher your sink. And you should also, in either case, you should clean it with Fantastic or something, so that way the taste of that ammonia gets into it, and then that's enough to kosher for Pesach. You know, cleaning around the spout is also a good idea. I mean, it's not a big deal, but you know, anywhere in your kitchen, food could get everywhere, so it's always good to clean every inch of space that you could try to get to, that it's easy to get to, in terms of you know, places where food might have gone to. And then in terms of your oven and your microwave, so most microwaves are usually, there's two parts of microwave. Most microwaves do not get hot enough on the walls and stuff like that. If you can test it, you see if you use a microwave for like a couple minutes, and then you put your finger on the side of Heinemann, you're supposed to do this. You put your finger on the side of the microwave, and if you can hold it there for like 10 seconds, then there's no question it doesn't get hot enough, and it's, you just have to clean it, and you don't have to kosher it at all. The problem with microwaves is that the bottom usually gets very hot. There's like a glass dish over there. So since you're cooking in your food, so what I would do is I would either get rid of the glass dish for the Pesach or just make sure it's double covered with some saran wrap or something, double wrapped. Double wrapping is a magic trick in kosher because basically the halacha is if you have two, even if they're paper thin, the two different vessels, so to speak, that separate between the food and the utensil, or the food and a non-kosher food, so then that will be a separation that you can't transfer. So, for instance, a good example is this is airline food. If you look at airline food, there's always two levels of like very thin tin foil, and that basically separates. They cook in the same oven with pork open, which they do, and it won't affect your kosher food because those two layers don't allow the pork to penetrate through to the kosher food. So there's a similar principle by a microwave, by the glass dish in a microwave. You want to like double wrap it on the bottom or anything you put in a microwave. You know, some people, what they'll do is they'll double wrap everything they put into a microwave just in case, which is not a bad practice at all. Even if you kosher, if you want to do that, it's a very nice thing to do. But if you kosher, it's not really necessary. What the best thing to do is just to take care of any part of your microwave. You test your microwave, see what gets hot, and then basically deal with it that way. If it gets very hot on the sides of the microwave or the bottom, and you can't cover that area, then it is acceptable to like kosher it out with like, you know, water or something, you know, boil water, and then the whole thing steams out. That's acceptable to do. And then you should also always take step Fantastic or something and clean the whole thing up, because that way it inserts inedible taste into the whole microwave. So that's, and then you can use your microwave on Pesach. Were you going to say something, Lisa?
Okay.
And then in terms of your stovetop, so you should clean that well, because food gets all over the place there, and you're all cooking on that stovetop. So cleaning it is very important, and it should be done also with something that's, you know, poisonous or something, easy off, whatever they use. Just, you know, because then you're doubly protected, so to speak. If you clean it well, you inspect it, you don't see any food there, and it's all clean, then preferably 24 hours from the last time you use it, and then put like a blech on top of the whole stove, if that's possible. You have something like that, like a cover the whole stove, turn on the burners for like a minute or two so the whole thing gets hot, and then that will kosher you the top of your stove. The problem with the top of the stove is really there's a lot of heat over there, so there is potential of chametz taste getting in there, and since it is kosherable, the proper thing to do is to kosher it. If you can't cover the whole stove, this is a little dangerous, so you have to be careful of the fire hazard. You know, sometimes you put a big fire could develop. There should be some air between. It doesn't have to be covered airtight, because then the fire is going to really gather together underneath that cover, that blech, whatever you put over there. But if there's air, usually it's not an issue. Like I have this blech, it's a great thing, it covers the whole, all four burners, and I just turn it on and the whole thing basically the stove gets very hot, and it's a couple minutes, it gets hot enough that it will, you know, the whole stove gets as hot as it's going to get, and it will kosher it that way. Are we going to say something else?
Electric
stovetops is the same thing.
It's glass. So
oh, glass. If it's going to break, if it's just glass, yeah. Yeah, I mean, you can do that. I mean, it's not going to help to it could break. If something can break, you don't have to kosher it. That's the rule. So in this case, then you're right. If it's going to break, you just fantastic it. Just make sure everything's clean, you don't see any food, and you put poison on the whole thing. That deals with it. And then the oven's the same thing. Basically, the oven's very easy if you have a self-cleaning oven. Just turn on a self-cleaning cycle, and the whole thing burns out. You just clean the door a little bit, make sure there's no food on the door. And inspect anything, you know, the broiler, you should inspect the broiler. You know, I put, like, bread in the broiler to, like, to heat hamburger buns sometimes, so that's something you should check. Make sure there's nothing there, and you should clean it. You know, you have someone helping you clean, that should be the focus. It should be your oven, your microwave, these things you cook on. And, you know, in the counters, you should clean every inch of it. But that's what you should make sure that they're clean. If the oven, any oven doors, you know. Again, the oven itself is easy if you have self-cleaning. Just turn on self-cleaning. If you don't have self-cleaning, just turn on the highest level for, you know, maybe an hour, half hour. That will get it very hot. And, you know, if you have easy off, that's even better. Then the whole thing gets clean. But if you have self-cleaning, then you don't even need any of that stuff. Because the oven gets boiling and boiling hot and self-cleaning. So I think that takes care of the kitchen.
Could you do the burners on top, like one at a time, just
yeah.
to see that it just gets each one gets red hot, and then you turn that one off? I just
definitely. The problem I'm talking about is the stove top, because
yeah.
not only does the burners get kosher with the blech, it's the stove top that gets kosher. So again, if you're afraid of a fire hazard, then you should not do it. But if you for a minute or two, sometimes it works to kosher the stove top. If not, then you could just clean it well with the Fantastic
yeah.
or something stronger than that or whatever it is, just to make sure and there's no food and that's it.
Yeah.
No kosher. Yeah. And a good practice, honestly, is if you're not going to kosher the stovetop properly, like really kosher it like with heat, then if something falls on there, you should probably, you know, if it's hot, you should probably throw it out and you know, not use it in Pesach. But not to say it's not kosher, but just that's a better thing to do. I mean, yeah, I feel better about doing that.
So, do you think it's
possible plates? So, yeah, that's also important. So, if someone wants to, I'm actually going to try to do that this year, but if someone has to kosher their pots and pans and utensils, so generally speaking, it only works with metal. So, glass, let me back up. If you use it for heat, okay? So what you mean is like you actually cook with it. I'm not talking about cups. I'm talking about like you actually cook with it. Plates and forks and spoons are an issue because a lot of times you cook with that also. Like I'll stick my spoon into the pasta thing, you know. But plates is a little easier because plates is cliche. Plates is not used to cook, generally speaking. So the transfer of taste usually, we could say, does not necessarily, according to many opinions, happen onto plates. But the problem with plates is that it's hard to kosher plates. So ideally, you should not use your china on Pesach. If it's necessary, then you could use it. Sfarim actually have a heter with this because Shulchan Aruch says glass doesn't absorb. So, and it's a cliche-y. So if someone really needs to use their china and your Sfarim, that's even better, then you could, you know, people, you know, it's a good, if you, as long as you clean it well, you could use it. But, you know, I personally feel better not using china like that on Pesach because hot food does get there and chametz could get absorbed inside. It's better to avoid if you can. But there's definitely, if someone used it, I wouldn't tell if it's not kosher. You know, it's definitely strong opinions to rely on to use china. And glass, the same thing. Glass is the same thing because glass is, even if it's used for hot liquid, most hot liquid is not chametz, you know, tea, coffee. It's not usually chametz. If you did, you know, if you use the oatmeal or something like that, something like that. So then, better not to use it. But if you need it, then there's definitely leniencies to be relied on to use it. Most people don't cook with glass, you know, as a clean rishon in there, you know, unless you put it in your microwave or something like that. Some people do that, but usually it's not cooked that way.
Need to retovel anything?
Toveling only you need to do once.
Koshering
is different than toveling. Koshering, yes. If you want to use stuff on Pesach, then you should kosher it. So that would mean your utensils, your pots. You want to use your pot on Pesach. One of the advantages, by the way, of Pesach is that you could transfer it from milchuk to fleishuk or fleishuk to milchuk. Normally, you're not allowed to use a fleishuk pot for milchuk, and even during the year, if you want to switch, you're not supposed to do that. But Pesach, if you kosher it for Pesach, Allah has brought down that you could then use that for the opposite. I remember we did that. There was a restaurant called Provi Provi, which was one of Miriam's favorite restaurants. It was a milchuk restaurant, and we went there on a date once, and then we decided we're going to go back for reminiscing, to reminisce. And it was fleishuk. We were shocked. Like, it was just milchuk last week. And it became Mike's Bistro, if you know Mike's Bistro. And basically, what they did, this Pesach trick, they were milchuk, and then they kashered everything. And then after Pesach, it became fleishuk. So that's how you switch over from milchuk to fleishuk is Pesach. But without that, if you want to use it on Pesach, you could use anything that's fully metal, like your utensils, your pots. Basically, it requires, the general rule is, the way you use it is the way you kosher it. So, for instance, you have pots and pans, you should kosher with filling up with water, boiling the water until you see, it really boils, and that will kosher the pot. Preferably should overflow to the sides, because that way you can cover the places that comments might have fallen on the sides. Some people put the pot in the oven, which may or may not be the proper thing to do for the outside of the pot. But whatever, it's not necessary to do that. Only cover the places that were cooked in. And then the pans, you have to make sure that they're not coated with any material that would not be kosherable potentially. And if that's the case, then you can kosher it easily by putting it upside down in a burner that burns out the whole inside of the pan, or putting it in the oven or something like that. You should preferably do both sides of the pan, and all these things should be cleaned totally first of any residue, and wait 24 hours since the last use, so that it's no sitan lefkam, so that any taste inside is spoiled, and then you kosher it after it becomes spoiled inside. And some people put soap in the water when they boil it. It's not necessary to do that, but I'm just letting you know it's not a hard thing to do. That's the pots and pans. And then utensils, basically you just boil a pot of water and put the utensils in. You could put multiple utensils in at one time, as long as you're sure that the water covers all the utensils. So potentially you could throw a bunch of utensils inside the pot at one time, and then it's all kosher that way, because especially leaving it for a few minutes, for like a minute, it got boiled. Every aspect of every area of the utensils got boiled that way, and it's a fast way to kosher utensils. I think that's it. Anything else that I didn't cover in terms of utensils?
This doesn't work for nonstick pans.
Right, so nonstick pans unfortunately have those coatings. So there's differences of opinion about that. So if you could live without it, it's probably better to do that, because you're actually cooking on it, and there is a potential halakhically to say that the food got absorbed inside and that it can't be koshered out. So it's better not. But again, if someone used that, I wouldn't say they're not using kosher. I mean, especially if they koshered it. If it's like a really serious situation, you need it, so then there's a way around it. But ideally, just not, if you don't need it, it's better to avoid it because of the fact you're cooking on it. So I think that covers the utensils. And then in terms of food on Pesach, so generally speaking, you should buy things with a hechsher, if possible, the kosher Pesach, OUP, whatever it is. But in Center City, I found a lot of products are not available. So my personal practice is to, if necessary, that I read ingredients. And it's important to know that when you read ingredients, to know what every ingredient is. You can't just read ingredients and say, it doesn't look chametz, so it's okay. You shouldn't do that. You should make sure every ingredient is not derived from chametz, because you're actually eating it. So be careful. When it comes to kidney oats, so last year I did a lot of research on this, and I gave an infamous sermon that most things that people call kidneys today, it doesn't apply to you guys, but most things that people buy call kidneys, they are not kidney oats at all. Kidney oats are, the Shulchan Aruch brings down a rice, and he says the various types of beans. So the rice is clearly kidney oat, person should not eat rice. But when it comes to like various type of beans, very unclear what that means. So we are usually strict about most beans, But there are a lot of things that are known to not have existed in Europe at the time this custom came into play. And since this custom itself really doesn't have a good reason anymore, back then the reason was because they actually packed it with comets and you were afraid. So they made a custom that people didn't eat. It's only custom. It's not an injunction or anything like that. It's just a custom. Now, doesn't mean you shouldn't keep a custom. It's important to keep a custom, especially one that is brought down in Shulchan Aruch. However, back then, there's certain things they didn't have. So there's no way it was included in the custom. And Rav Moshe Feinstein writes, fried peanuts, for instance, the peanuts didn't exist in Europe. Since they didn't exist in Europe, he says it's completely allowed to eat peanuts on Pesach. It's not called kidney oil. Many other poskim would say that applies to soy, that applies to corn, because these things didn't exist in Europe either. So nowadays, people are stringent about it. I spoke to a number of big poskim who say that's completely okay. As a matter of fact, I was told that before the kashrus agencies existed, all the Gedolim, all the great Torah scholars used to eat corn and soy and straight out of a can, you know, stuff like that. You know, just it was never considered to be kidney oil. So on top of the fact that most products that you worried about, if someone wants you to can of corn on Pesach, I would say it's okay. But I'm talking about even more than that. I'm talking about there are products that you have corn syrup. So corn syrup is like much better than corn. Even if you say corn is kidney oil, but then there are many opinions that say that corn oil is not kidney oil because it's liquefied. Well, liquefied is not no longer to kidney oil anymore because the problem of the eating it together with chametz doesn't exist. And some say that if you completely change the corn into a completely different food item called nishtan al-gamer, completely changed, then that's also even if you hold that corn oil is not allowed, that would be allowed. But even clearer is the fact that Shulchan Aruch says that Rama brings down that who brings this halacha that if it's nullified in majority, 49% kidney oil, 51% kosher Pesach food, then the kidney oil is nullified. Now you shouldn't do that outright. You shouldn't take shouldn't say oops and pour rice into your soup. So if that's the case in the Rama, rice falls in soup or something, and it's less than 50%, then it's allowed. He says you could eat it on Pesach even if that happened. But this is even more so because this is the company itself nullified it. They had no intention to nullify it. It's an ingredient in a food that they're producing for non-Jews. They're not doing it for you. And this is what I always say about food in general when you read ingredients, and that is that nullification is an issue only if a Jew is making for another Jew and they nullify it on purpose. Then there's a rabbinical injunction about outright nullifying things. But if it's non-Jew making for non-Jews, then a Jew could buy that food because even if it's nullified, but it's done by someone who's not Jewish with no prohibition on them to nullify food. So therefore, for the Jew to buy it is okay. So on Pesach, it would be the same thing. So my personal opinion is if you can easily buy a kosher Pesach food, you have a Pesach in Lakewood or Muncie or Borough Park, then you should just buy kosher Pesach food. But if you're in Center City and it's very hard to find it, and you can read every ingredient. So I went through Häagen-Dazs ice creams, and a lot of them, I haven't found one. Maybe I don't want to say a straight out statement like that. But you really need the ingredients, but the sorbets and the ice creams, all the only issue would be something like soy lecithin, or corn syrup, which are definitely less than 50% of the product, and they're liquefied, and they're items that were not in the original injunction, like soy and corn, and they're changed completely to another form. So all these things together, to me, is like a little ridiculous to say that you can't eat it because it's like five different levels. I mean, it's first of all, it's a custom. And then you have the doubt whether it even existed in the custom at all. Then you have a doubt whether oil. Then you have a doubt whether it's since it's changed. And on top of it, it's nullified, which the Rama says is okay, even if you know for sure it's kidney oil. I have no understanding why that's not okay. I mean, it doesn't make any sense. It's so clearly okay. There's four different doubts and a clear halacha that it's allowed. So, I would say, look, it doesn't hurt. And you're not worried about chametz being in there because these things are produced before Pesach. And even though one in a million rule only applies on Pesach. But if it was made before Pesach, it doesn't apply. So if a piece of chametz falls into something on let's say 2 days before Pesach, and it's nullified, then you can eat that on Pesach because it's considered to be nullified. Because this injunction only applies on Pesach that it's one in a million. So therefore, all these products, ice creams, are made, you know, days or weeks in advance before they show up in the store, which means that even if there was a drop of hummus that fell in, which is very unlikely, it's still been nullified. So you don't have to worry about the chametz falling in, therefore you can rely on the ingredients. And if the only issue with the ingredients is soy, corn, especially corn syrup or something that's made into a different different texture, different food item, it's nullified in majority. In that situation, I would say there's no real justifiable reason why that's not okay to buy on Pesach. And there are many, many food products like this that don't have a haksha because the kash agencies are stringent about this, but halakhically, it's very hard to argue that it's someone who does practice that way is doing the wrong thing.
So, for instance, tofu would be fine?
So tofu is one of those things where that's not, you don't have the leniency of being less than 50%. So it's not as good, but you could rely on it because soy was not in the original injunction, so you could rely on those opinions that say soy is not kidney oil.
And if it's something that has tofu, it will be less than 50%.
That's different. That if it's less than 50%, I would say that's much clearly okay.
For instance, going to sushi and get something.
No, sushing is
tofu.
Sushing I would worry about because sushing they make if you're on Pesach. There is chametz in the store. I would not buy from a restaurant that is not kosher Pesach on Pesach. I would not do that. I'm talking about items that are produced in a factory, which is very controlled conditions. There's no other ingredients. It's made before Pesach. I wouldn't go to Shushin because they don't care if a piece of bread falls into your food item. And that's something you should be stringent about. So it's good you brought that up because I'm not referring to buying freshly made food in a restaurant. I'm talking about
like a packaged.
Packaged, like tofu-di. So tofu-di doesn't have the I think it's a majority, so it doesn't have that thing. So you're relying on the fact that soy is not in the original injunction, and it's made into a different food, and it's also, you know, liquefied. So that's a lot to rely on. You know, I personally would feel better if it's nullified, but if someone eats tofu-di and there's really no hummus in it, I don't see any reason why that's not okay. I mean, that's really should be okay also.
So what about yogurt?
Yogurt's the same thing.
Same thing. It doesn't need to be hectored?
No, you have to make sure you know every ingredient. I'm not saying that there are ingredients in, you know, obviously if there's granola in it, you can't eat it.
Right.
Oreo cookies.
Yeah, right.
But most yogurts that I've looked into, the only issue is like soy lecithin or something like that, which is also the same issue. That's fine. So most yogurts that I've been, I mean, I had to tell the story a couple of years ago about this couple who was in shul, and the kid only ate yogurt. Wouldn't eat anything else. He put chocolate there. He wouldn't eat anything else but yogurt, and they were freaking out. Not just only yogurt, only a certain brand of yogurt. It wasn't kosher pest. So I was explaining, then I didn't research the kidney oil as much, and I told him, like, anyway, kids are allowed to eat kidney oil. But now I think that's okay for adults, because the kidney oats are not really kidney oats. It's just soy lecithin or something like that. So as long as you're sure that there's none of the ingredients have what's his name, chametz in it, then I would say that's fine. So that's it. I mean, you know, like I said, the packaged food, I explained, you know, that if it's open, you just make sure there's no chametz when inside. Any fresh food is okay. Whatever, like meats, or doesn't have to be kosher Pesach as long as it's kosher. Fish, stuff like that. Especially, you know, fresh vegetables, you know, nothing to worry about. All these things people say about, like, you know, paper towels, because, you know, all these things. What's the reason? Cornstarch. Cornstarch is not even kidney oil, probably. So, I'm not concerned about any of these paper plates. Phone cups, all these things are not, you know, they write in the books you can't have. I've not seen a justifiable reason why this stuff is not okay. Any questions that I didn't cover? I'm sure I didn't cover certain things, but I don't know if anyone can think of anything.
I want to clarify about the thing.
Yeah.
Is it just using it with chametz? Like, could you go wash your hands in the sink?
Yeah.
Or,
yeah. Hot chametz is the ideal. I mean, let's put it this way. There are different opinions that say that if you use it for hot food within the last 24 hours, even if it's not hummus, then that's also considered to be something that would ruin the 24-hour rule. However, you don't have to do that because the 24-hour rule is just a stringency. Basically, what we're saying is, really, if you kosher something that has viable chametz inside, it's still kosher l'pesach. It's just the stringency because we say we'd rather that the food be add an extra layer of protection. The food is spoiled after 24 hours. Mm-hmm. And there are also opinions, and this is I rely on a lot of different situations, that say that even if you cooked something else in it, just the opposite. It would, in a sense, kosher it. Not only would it not make it a problem that you, the 24-hour rule, but it would kosher it, which would make it better. So you can rely on that for sure, and therefore you can use the sink for as long as you don't use the hot chametz, it's fine within 24 hours. All right. I hope I covered a lot of stuff. I don't know if I covered anything, but in general, if you have any questions, you should always feel free to call me or email me at any time.
I have a practical question.
Yeah.
Will be living down for the first days. So when we do it.
Just for the first days?
Yeah.
Are you going to be there the rest of the time? And you're going to be here Thursday night or not?
Probably not.
So then you're supposed to check the last night that you're here. And you don't make a bracha. Right. So if you're here Wednesday night, then you check Wednesday night.
And why is it at night when you can see better during the day?
So that's a legitimate question. So there's different opinions about that. My Rosh Yeshiva used to have a very interesting answer, which I don't know scientifically if this is true. But he based on Yerushalmi says that this is brought down, and no one understands this halacha. It says that the light shines better at night. Now, what does that mean? Natural sunlight would seemingly be a lot better than a candlelight in the darkness.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? So what he said was very interesting. He brought Yerushalmi that said that people would hide in caves from the Romans. Jews were hiding in caves from the Romans. And they asked the question, how do they know when to say Kriyat Shema in the morning? How do they know when to say at night? So it said they would light a fire. And when the fire shone brighter, they knew it was night. It's just like a scientific phenomenon that at nighttime, things brighten up. Artificial light, so to speak, not from the sun. Fire or candles or something like that.
The light looks brighter, but the chametz would still be harder to see.
But think about what I'm saying. The case is that's true. The case is you're in a cave. You have no idea if it's night or darkness. The light, the light itself will illuminate more because it's nighttime. Mm. So what that's saying is that when you're in your house, the fire in your house, the candle in your house will actually do a better job lighting your house up, according to that, than the sun. That's what it's saying. But nowadays, basically, the most important thing is to illuminate the house. So people ask about candles. So there's a custom. So I usually start the day with a candle. But you shouldn't check your house with a candle. A, because it doesn't do a good job, and because it's a fire hazard. I know people who actually have their house caught on fire from that. So especially, I still people looking at closets with their clothes with a candle. Not a good idea. So you should use a flashlight in places that, people turn off the light, which I don't understand at all. You don't turn off the light. You probably illuminate as much as possible. The rabbis made a junction that it should be at night. So we do it at night. We don't do it during the day. And, there's this logic. Another logic is, which is the psychological issue, which is that you're more careful because if it's darker, it's sort of like you're fighting the tide. It's sort of like, if it's harder to see, so then you'll make more of an effort to check. Otherwise you take things for granted. So that's when the injunction is, and that's what we do it at night. But I'm not saying it's so clear why it's better than during the day, but different reasons given, and that's the injunction is to do it at night. Yeah.
Well, maybe it's because it's time sensitive. So whenever you have whenever the last day before Pesach starts, you want to do it.
Well, you could argue that you should do it the day before. Why do you start at night? Start Thursday during the day.
The day starts last week. Yeah. So whenever it's time, you just go.
So I'm saying, but if it's better to check during the day, so then check Thursday. They could have done that very easily. Check from Alos. A lot of times in Halakha we say the day starts in the morning. Even though you're right, the day starts at night, but a lot of things we say the day starts in the morning. So we could have done it out. whatever, they decided to do it at night, so that's when we do it. But you should, like I said, you should illuminate as much as possible and just make it easier for you to check. And a candle is not the best way nowadays. Back then, the candle was the only thing they had. They didn't have light bulbs. So that's our light bulbs. And I said that for Shabbos candles too, by the way. Shabbos candle, one of the purposes of Shabbos candles is to illuminate the house, which means that the lights do a much better job of that. So if you're in a hotel where they don't allow candles, it's totally okay to turn a light for Shabbos candles. You know, one of the reasons Shalom Bayis, shouldn't bump into people. Candles are not going to help you not bump into people. So, you know, the lights in your house are do a much better job. So that really qualifies as Shabbos candles. And the same thing with B'dikas Chametz. So the best thing to use is the best light available. All right?
Thank you.
Pleasure. Like I said, if you have any questions, feel free to contact me anytime. We'll see each other before, but good luck cleaning and Chag Hashanah Sameach.
Thank you.